Hi, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast on statistics for the social sciences. We have just a few episodes left, a few more weeks of material. So at this point, what we're going to be doing is a lot more just reinforcing what we learned last week, in particular, the testing steps that we've gone through and how those apply to different groups or variables we want to examine to determine if they're significant, right? So combining significance, hypothesis testing, and then what specific tests we need to do depending on the types of groups we have or really how many variables we have. Our objectives for this conversation listed out in our slides for week 11. First, we need to review those testing steps. We're going to do that pretty regularly from here on out. And I'm going to be asking you to apply those testing steps so that you get very comfortable with them. And then we're going to learn about our major test for this week, the one sample Z test, confusingly enough, also called the one sample T test. So I'm going to say practice it as the one sample test. Then we're going to continue using that decision tree process to figure out which test we use, because how do we get to the one sample test? Well, basically by knowing we're comparing a population and a sample, aka looking at two different groups and then figuring out which types of groups we're examining. I do have a handout that I've posted this week with our slides, which is entitled What Test to Choose? And I think it's a little easier to use than the decision tree in the book, but regardless, it's another option that helps you figure out, am I doing a one sample test? Am I doing t-tests? What's an ANOVA for? And the like. And then I also have a short handout with the testing steps, which goes through those, again, in kind of a one-pager format. It's going to be the same thing as what we go over in these slides, but I've developed these and a few of the others to just make it easy to have a shorthand little PDF regarding significance, critical values, the tests you need to choose, and what those testing steps are. The last few things we need to touch on are, what do we mean by effect size when it comes to a one sample test? And here, go back to that significance versus what's meaningful. Think back to that slide comparing, let's say, statistical significance and practical significance. Practical significance is, what kind of effect are we looking at? Is this a big effect, a small effect? What are we dealing with here? And I believe the example I used was my COVID treatment. Well, if my COVID treatment is statistically significant, proven to make you better faster, but only 15 minutes faster, and it costs you $1,000 more than what's already available, well, that's practically not very helpful, not very meaningful, not a really good effect size. But if it helped you get better a week faster and it only cost you $50 more, that might be worth it. The effect size there might be practically meaningful, okay? That's what we mean by effect size. And last but not least, we will talk about those peer reviews and how that system is going to work, because that is coming up over the next 2 weeks here. But before we get too far down that rabbit hole, let's jump into our slides for week 11. You can find those, of course, on the week 11 roadmap page or on any roadmap page that is tied to the one sample Z test. And on slide 3, we're repeating kind of what the visuals are, the 5-step process that I've described. Now, in my slides, I have the testing steps listed as 5 separate steps, but your textbook lists them as 8. It doesn't actually matter which approach you use. They're both going to walk you through the same process. I just think mine's a little more direct, particularly with the last step, where your book separates out the last step between accepting and rejecting the null hypothesis. I consider that basically one step that you would do. So this is why I've kind of set it up this way. But regardless, the steps in our testing process consist of writing out our null hypothesis first. Next, choose your significance level, or the risk you're willing to be wrong about rejecting that null hypothesis. Then we're going to calculate our test statistic once we figured out what test we need to do. And that's going to be based on what groups we're comparing or how many variables we're looking at. And then we're going to compare what we've got from our test to what's known as a critical value. Again, for visual comparisons, I like to think of this as like the high jump. Do you have to clear a 6-foot bar or an 8-foot bar or a 10-foot bar? Whatever that bar is, that's our critical value. And if our result from our test is more extreme than that critical value, meaning if it's a larger number on the positive side or a smaller, more negative number on the negative side, well, then we've found something statistically significant and we can reject the null hypothesis. That, by the way, is what is meant when I say if the test statistic exceeds the critical value. Exceeds means more extreme. Again, more negative if it's a negative number. So if my critical value is -2, my test statistic has to be below -2, like -2.5 or -3. If my test statistic is looking at a positive critical value, like 1.5, it would have to be a larger positive number than that. My test statistic could be 1.6. That's greater than 1.5. And I can reject the null hypothesis and say, this isn't due to chance. There's something else going on here. Now, in the testing world, you're going to see these steps. And this would be what we would do if we had to physically look up a critical value, which we're actually going to practice a little bit here today. But if you don't do it with, let's say, a manual hand calculation process and you use a program like SPSS, those last two steps are going to be slightly different. We still write the null, we still set our significance level, and we still run our statistical test and calculate our test statistic. But in SPSS, we're going to be looking at the p-value or the significance level associated with that test statistic. Right at this moment, I want you to pause where you're at with the slides, and I actually want you to go back to the Week 10 roadmap page and pull up the significance and p-values handout. It's going to be located where the slides normally are, and what I want you to look at that is page 2 of that handout. Now, what that says at the top of page 2 is where you can find significance in SPSS results. And in each of the tables listed on page 2, there's an orange rectangle outlining that significance. Well, that is our p-value. Remember, probability is what the p stands for, and significance is essentially the same thing. What's the probability that we get this result due to chance, or what's our significance level? Well, when it comes to SPSS, we're going to look at the p-values in those tables and say, is it less than what we set in step 2? So let's say I'm willing to be wrong 1 out of 20 times. I have a p-value of 0.05. I'm going to look at these tables and I'm going to look for that p-value, whether it's a one-sided or two-sided, and decide, okay, first of all, do I have a one-sided hypothesis or a directional hypothesis? Or do I have a two-tailed hypothesis where I say there's just some sort of effect? I don't know if the effect is greater than or less than, or maybe I don't know the direction, so I have a non-directional hypothesis. In that instance, I want to look at my two-sided p when it's listed that way in each table. And you can see as you look through that handout, there's usually a one-sided and two-sided if we're dealing with t-tests. When we get further down and we look at an ANOVA, there's no one-sided and two-sided because we're comparing three groups. So really, what we're looking for there is simply, is there a difference? Or the very last table is for a linear regression, and the coefficients, we're just trying to figure out, are they significant? Regardless of the table that I'm looking at, if I'm saying my significance level from step 2 is 0.05, then I need to have a p-value in my test results, aka in these tables, that is smaller than 0.05. So something like 0.04, 0.01, 0.001, all of those are smaller than 0.05. And that is what I'm looking to see in my test results to say, okay, my p-value from my test is lower or less than my level of significance from step 2, and I can reject the null hypothesis. The testing steps are a little different. Again, between doing this by hand and looking up a critical value in a table, versus running a statistical program like SPSS. And generally speaking, I'm going to be having you do more with the SPSS steps. So if you understand that, where your p-value, step four, needs to be a smaller number than your level of significance from step two, then you'll be all right. And generally, I do want to also say, for our significance level, that step two of our testing process, we typically use 0.05. We don't often go above or below that unless we have a very small amount of data, in which case we might set our p-value at 0.1, because smaller numbers mean it's going to be harder to find an effect. So if we see something at the 10% level, that's pretty effective. Versus, let's say we see a ton of data, like we have hundreds of thousands of data points, we might set our significance at p of 0.01. So we're only going to have a 1 in 100 chance, and we're going to be raising that bar to be a higher level, in which case our p-value has to be below 0.01 to say, yes, what we've got here is significant. It is largely dependent on the amount of data that you have. For the purposes of this class, we're going to say the significance level for any SPSS assignment is 0.05. So when you get to that last step and you're comparing that p-value from your SPSS results to 0.05, if it's below 0.05, you're going to reject the null hypothesis. And below means less than. So 0.04, 0.02, 0.001. Those are all less than 0.05. If it's above 0.05, as in 0.06, 0.1, 0.2, we're going to have to accept our null hypothesis and say, well, this could be due to chance. Okay, I want you to navigate your way back to the regular slides and know that we'll continue coming back to this discussion around p-values, significance, and how we do the testing. But the next few slides are a repeat of our testing steps from the last episode, where we had the null hypothesis, my null hypothesis about programming having an effect on whether people come back to prison. And that null hypothesis could be non-directional, where I just say, hey, I think programming affects chances of coming back to prison. Or it could be directional, where I say something more like programming is going to decrease the chances of someone coming back to prison. The difference there, directional tells me the nature of the relationship between my independent and dependent variable. One increases and the other decreases, or both increase together. Versus simply saying, I think it has an effect, but I don't know what that effect is. Does it make it bigger? Does it make it smaller? We don't really know with a non-directional null hypothesis. Either version is absolutely fine for writing out a null hypothesis, and that completes step one. Step two, I'm going to choose my significance level, and just for consistency's sake, we're going to always go in this podcast and in the materials that I present to you with 0.05. So I'm going to have a 1 in 20 chance that I reject the null when I shouldn't, or in other words, that I say, hey, this isn't due to chance when it actually is. That is our type 1 error, or a false positive. All the same kind of terminology, all meaning the same thing. When I say, again, something else is going on here, and maybe programming affects coming back to prison, but it really doesn't. Let's not assume we've made that error just yet. Let's wait and finish our testing steps and run our test to see what results we get. But that moves us into really thinking about what type of hypothesis connected with our significance level we've got going on. If I have a non-directional null hypothesis, then I have a two-tailed test, where I'm splitting that significance into each tail, saying, well, it could be an effect that's positive or an effect that's negative. And in that case, my critical values are going to be tied to splitting that significance in each of the tails. Kind of like what you see on slide 7 here, okay? Slide 7 has the two-tailed or one-tailed listed at the top with the purple normal distributions. And the non-directional is the normal distribution on the left, where I've split my 5% in both the positive and negative tails of that distribution. A one-tailed test, which would be directional, would put all of the significance, all of that area, that 5% under the curve in either the right-hand side, if it's going to be a positive effect, or the left-hand side if it's a negative effect, right? That's what determines my critical values. The spot at the bottom where those Z-score standard deviations are listed, where you see from the 0 to the 1 to the 2, on the left-hand side, that critical value, if I was doing a Z-score, would be like 1.96 or negative 1.96. My test statistic would have to be greater than 1.96 or less than negative 1.96 to say, aha, we've got something significant here. We can reject the null. But if I'm doing a one-tailed test, then I would have to be looking for a critical value of more like a 1.65 and something greater than that. Because as you can see, I'm on the positive side with all of my significance. I need something to land in that area of the normal distribution where all of the purple is on the right in order to say, yes, we can reject the null here. You can see another example on slide 8 where I've done a little bit more explaining about how you split the significance into the two tails for a two-tailed test, and you leave it all in one tail for a one-tailed test. This is only really going to come into play when we have to look at those test results. And if you remember looking at the significance handout, we had a one-sided P and a two-sided P in the tables. A one-sided P is the directional hypothesis, right? So in the one tail where we have the 5%, is it less than 0.05 on the one-sided? Versus if I have a non-directional null and I go to the two-sided P, what's the p-value there? So that's how we're going to pull that into actually evaluating our significance and our null hypothesis. When we read those test results from SPSS, we're going to know, okay, if I have a directional hypothesis, I focus on the one-sided p-value in the table, if there is one. And if I have a non-directional null hypothesis, where I say there's just some effect, I'm going to look at the two-sided p in that table. Okay, step 3, select the right test and calculate the test statistic. And here, what I encouraged you to do was to look in your Chapter 9, Table 9.1, or Figure 9.1, excuse me, which is around page 178 in the physical copy of the book. If you're working with an electronic copy of the book, it should be somewhere around page 178. My electronic copy places it around page 177, 178, but it really depends on the electronic version of the book you have. So just make sure you find Figure 9.1, and let's go from there. This decision tree is supposed to guide you through figuring out which test you're doing. So if I have groups that I'm looking at, groups that I'm comparing, and I would for my current research question comparing, like, let's say inmates with programming and inmates without, that's two different groups. So if I have two groups, I go to one direction on that decision tree, and then it asks me, are the same participants being tested more than once? And for my research question, the answer is no. Which leads me to the next question, how many groups are you dealing with? And I say two, which results in a t-test for independent samples. That practice is just exactly how we use that decision tree, to walk us through figuring out what our answers to different questions are and result in a specific test that we're going to use. But I've developed something a little bit, in my opinion, easier to work with, and this is, again, going to ask you to navigate away from the slides for a minute and head back to that week 11 roadmap page, at which point I want you to click on the What Test to Choose handout, located again with the slides. On this handout, what we've got is just a single page where I'm describing three different types of tests: t-tests, ANOVAs, and regressions. And what you're going to get for each type of test is a general description. So like for the t-test, it says, if I am interested in just comparing groups and I'm focusing on comparing up to two groups on only one measure or variable, which is usually the mean, I choose a type of t-test. Or for the ANOVA, if I'm interested in comparing groups and I'm focusing on comparing more than two groups on one measure or variable, usually the mean, I choose a type of ANOVA. Then if I'm looking at how an independent variable or multiple independent variables, affect a dependent variable, I choose regression. Now, I personally prefer this handout because I think the description is a little bit easier to understand. And there's some visuals and some additional explanations about which type of t-test or which type of ANOVA or which type of regression based on how many groups you have or how many variables you have. But again, these are just two options to get you to the same place, and that's through step three, figuring out which test to use. If this handout works better for you, go ahead and use it. And if the book works better for you, use that. Whichever tool is best for you is great by me. Okay, making our way back to our slides, we have figured out that I am going to be doing a t-test for independent samples, so I'm going to take my data and I'm going to plug it into SPSS, and that's going to give me, in step four, a test statistic, my p-value, and then I'm going to compare that with my level of significance from step two, if I was using SPSS to do all of the work. Now, if I'm having to do this by hand, I actually have to look up the critical values myself. So if you look back, and I know I'm switching back and forth between handouts and slides willy-nilly this time, if you look back at the week 10 roadmap page and you pull up that significance and p-values handout, that page 2 with those tables has some numbers usually on the far left-hand side, which are actually our test statistics. So anytime I'm looking at a t-test, like for the one sample t-test or the independent samples t-test, my test statistic is the number listed under the lowercase t. For the first test listed, it's a -1.681. For the independent samples t-test table, I have two of them. One is 1.168, where it says the equal variances are assumed, and the second is 1.124, where it says equal variances not assumed. For my dependent samples t-test, the test statistic is under the t there, and that's the +3.893. Might be a little hard to see on these handouts, but that is your actual test statistic. That is, if we had to do a comparison with, you know, a critical value saying a t-test must be greater than or less than this number, that is the test statistic we're using to compare to that critical value. This is our result. So that is our test statistic listed there. And then we would need to figure out what our critical value is by looking at, okay, what's our level of significance in comparison to where we draw the lines on that normal distribution, not unlike figuring out the area for a z-score. Okay, totally a lot to throw at you right there. But think about it this way. When I ask you on the midterm exam to figure out what a z-score is and what a z of 2.5 is, well, you are actually figuring out the area underneath the curve and the area to the right of that, which tells you what's the chances of getting that specific z-score of 2.5. And the chances weren't very high, right? It's a pretty rare number. That z of 2.5 is more extreme than the significance or the p-value associated with a 5%, which would actually put the z-score critical value at like a 1.96. Okay, so really what we have to do here, if we're doing this manually, and I promise not to ask this of you again in the future, is to say, all right, if I'm only wrong 5% of the time, and I have a non-directional null hypothesis, and I have 2.5% in each of the ends of my tail, what is my critical value at 2.5%? So what is the z-score at which I have an area of 2.5% above it, or 0.025, right? That would be the 2.5%. In order to know that, what I would do is I'd go back to my table in the back of the book in Appendix B, and I would look up an area of 0.475 or 47.5, because that, again, is the area between the mean and that critical value, leaving 2.5% in the tail. If you need to do this visually, I absolutely strongly encourage it, but draw out your normal distribution and figure out where's the cutoff for 2.5% left in the tail, or an area of 0.025 still in the tail. We can know that by saying, okay, half of the normal distribution is 50%. And if we know the area between the mean, the middle of that hill, and that z-score is 0.025, okay, that's our cutoff. That's our critical value. And if we have a non-directional null hypothesis, we're going to say that critical value, it could be either positive or negative. And as long as our test statistic is more extreme than that, we're going to be okay with saying we're going to reject the null hypothesis. So I want you to practice this process briefly. I want you to go to Appendix B and figure out what is the Z-score that matches an area of 5% if all of our significance was in one tail, right? You're going to be looking for an area of 45 between the mean and the curve. What's that value? Email that to me once you figure that out. What's that Z-score? Okay. Now repeat this with 2.5%. Okay. The area between the mean and the curve is going to be 47.5. What is the critical value at 2.5%? Or in other words, what's the Z-score for an area between the mean and that value of 47.5? That's my critical value for a two-tailed test. Please do email those to me and let me know what you get for results, and I can say, okay, yep, you've figured out the area correctly, or maybe we need to repractice the steps. And either way is okay. Again, we're learning this all. We're going to be practicing a lot more and getting more comfortable with it. All right, once you've done that, let's proceed to step 5. If our test statistic is more extreme, again, more positive than a certain positive number, or smaller than or more negative than a certain negative number, we say, okay, we're going to reject the null. There's something else going on here. This isn't due to chance, or it's very unlikely that this happened just by chance. So something else is going on. And generally, we think whatever we've put together as an idea for what's causing that effect that we think is going on is probably the culprit. So programming is probably affecting people going back to prison. That's a good thing. That's good to know. It's also, by the way, just as good to know if there is no relationship. Within the social sciences, we tend to focus on significant results or something where we can reject the null. But it's just as critical, frankly, to know when we don't reject the null that, hey, this might actually not be a variable or something that's causing an effect that we think is going on. If we find out the programming has no effect on return to prison, that's important for us to know and understand in the real world. Because maybe we can stop offering classes that don't really have a positive effect and do something instead that actually does reduce someone's chances of returning to prison. It's thinking about the bigger real-world effects of our research, and knowing that there might not be a real effect is just as helpful to us as knowing when there is one. Okay, jumping to slide 14. What you're going to see there is, that's slide 13. What we're going to see here is those critical values identified for different significance levels. So, this is kind of cheating if you went right through this and you didn't look up the actual critical values for the 5% or the 2.5%. What you can see here is if I have a one-sided null hypothesis saying it's a positive effect, then if my Z-score is greater than 1.645, I'm in that 5% zone and I can reject the null hypothesis. If my 5% is split, as in I have a non-directional null hypothesis, programming just has an effect, my Z-score has to be greater than 1.96, which is the critical value at 2.5%, or less than negative 1.96, which on the left-hand side is the critical value for 2.5% in the left side tail of that normal distribution. That's what we mean by critical values. Those critical values are in the box on the bottom. Those are the Z-scores that we need to have a value in our test statistic of being more extreme then. If we said we were only going to take a 1% chance that we are wrong, our Z-score would have to be greater than 2.576 or less than negative 2.576 with a two-tailed test. With a one-tailed test, it'd have to be even more extreme than that. All right. All that said, I do repeat what kind of the explanation of the process is on slide 14, actually, where I say if the p-value in SPSS is less than 0.05, we can reject the null. We need to be looking at the right p-value, whether it's a one-sided or a two-sided. And that's going to be critical for you on the upcoming SPSS assignments. But if you see a p-value less than 0.05 and you've got the right test, you can reject the null. So that takes us through a review of everything we did last time, but with a little bit more emphasis on the steps and the process. And now we can talk about what a one sample test is. So with a one sample test laid out on slide 15, let's say you know about your population. And the reason I use turtles on these images is because turtles are one of those rare species where sometimes there's only 200 or 300 left in the world. You might be able to access the whole population. You might be able to study the whole population, particularly if they live in areas like the Galapagos. That's one specific location, one limited species. We might be actually able to study a whole population, and we might be able to use that population for comparisons to a sample that we are looking at to see if it's different. So my example, slide 15, I know about my population of turtles from a specific species, and I want to know whether a small group of this population that directly experienced an oil spill is affected by that spill. So I use, in this instance, a one sample Z-test or T-test, whatever the language is, you're always going to be looking for that one sample component. So in my examination, let's say I have my population of turtles and I have a sample of 50 post-oil spill turtles. My 50 oil spill turtles weigh about 289 pounds. That's not a crazy number, by the way, for turtles. They're pretty heavy depending on whether you have like the large species or the smaller ones. But my regular population, their average is 295. The standard deviation is 7 pounds. Well, how do I know if they're significantly different? I mean, is 289 really that different from 295, considering the standard deviation is only 7? I mean, 289 is within one standard deviation of 295. If we were just looking at this with a standard Z-score where we took the value minus the average or the mean and divided by the standard deviation, we'd get an answer that says, no, this isn't significantly different. But when we're comparing a sample against a population, we have a slightly different formula. And that's pictured on slide 18, where we take our sample average, subtract our population average, or sample mean minus population mean, and then we divide by what is known as the standard error of the mean, which is not the same as the standard deviation. The formula for that standard error, by the way, slide 19, is the population standard deviation divided by the square root of the size of our sample. Now, why do we use the standard error of the mean, especially when we're thinking about why couldn't we just do a standard Z-score? Well, again, a Z-score here is not going to have the right weighting for our data. And we're moving to a standard error of the mean because we could have multiple samples or multiple groups. Our population could have several different samples drawn from it, and we could get different, let's say, standard deviations from each sample. So there's variation across the samples, and there's variation within a sample. And so because those could look different, we're going to make the best guess about whether there's something significant going on by considering all of the variability across the samples, as pictured on slide 20. Standard error, the variability across the samples. Standard deviation is the variability within a sample. So we're not just looking at one possible sample. We got to account for the fact that these might be really different samples from one another. This helps us understand how much this difference is between the sample and the population versus what we might expect to find. So let's bring it back to our example. I've got my mean for my population, 295, and my standard deviation for my population. I have 50 in my sample, so that's my sample size or N, and then my sample average is 289. So calculate it. What is our actual one sample Z-score value here? Take the first step of the standard error of the mean, which is the standard deviation of the population divided by the square root of the sample size, and then put that on the denominator side of the Z-score. take your 289 minus 295 and divide by that value. And when you get that, let me know what you get. Did you actually do it? Did you send me an email with your calculation? Because I want to know what you actually find here. What is your calculation, right? It's going to be interesting to see what results you get because, again, if I had done this as a standard z-score, 289 minus 295 divided by 7, that's a z-score of less than 1. But standard error of the mean is going to significantly change this result. All right, I've taken enough breaks. If you haven't done it yet, do the math and send me your results in an email. But if you've done the math, what you should be finding is, oh no, this is nothing like what a standard z-score would look like. This isn't like 6 divided by 7. This is like 6 divided by 1, which means our z-score is over 6. Now envision that on a normal distribution. How far away from the mean are we by now? We're talking 6 approximately standard errors or 6 standard deviations. Just think about how far into the tail we are, how unlikely this is. Or in other words, our oil spill turtles, they might be 6 pounds lighter, but that's a very significant difference. Or at least so we'd think. Let's go back to the prior conversation from before. What is statistically significant versus what is practically significant? Statistically significant, they're different. But practically significant, how much of an effect is this actually having? So, yes, the groups are different. And it's incredibly unlikely that that difference is due to chance or some sort of random factor. But again, we're only talking about 6 pounds. Is that really that big of an effect, or is it a small effect? Well, in order to know that, we have to calculate what is known as effect size. So the effect size is defined as the strength of the relationship between variables, which should sound disturbingly like things we've already talked about. Strength of a relationship, perhaps something almost like a correlation. So to figure out effect size between two groups, the population and the sample, you calculate what is known as a Cohen's D measure. Cohen's D is the effect size for comparisons between these two. And all you do here is subtract the population mean from the sample mean and divide by the standard deviation. Now, remember, not the standard error. So this is much more like calculating a regular z-score, a standardized z-score for that matter. Our value minus the population mean and then divide by the standard deviation, which is laid out on slide 25. 289 minus 295 divided by 7, or negative 6 over 7, is negative 0.86. Okay, great. But what in the world does that mean? How can we use this to decide whether our effect is big or small? Well, conveniently enough, we have some folks who've done much bigger and better math works than I have ever, or will ever, and they have learned for us what the size of the effect is that's big versus small. So 0.2 would be a small effect size, 0.5 a medium effect size, and 0.8 a large effect size. So at negative 0.8, and by the way, it doesn't matter if it's positive or negative, we'd be thinking about it either way as being significant. Negative 0.8 is a really big effect. And we can even visualize it like what you see on slide 27. Cohen's D is basically looking at how much do my groups overlap. If I make a normal distribution for each one, do they overlap a lot or a little or not very much? So the Cohen's D of 0.2 is the top visual where you can see the normal distributions are really close to one another and the means are really close to one another. So there's a ton of overlap. There's not a lot of space where one doesn't cross over with the other. The Cohen's D of 0.5, they move a little further apart. And the Cohen's D of 0.8, we now have a significant amount of each population that doesn't overlap with the other. We've really shifted the group because of whatever effect we are looking at. So here, our oil spill turtles have moved down quite a bit. And the entire group is going to have that different mean and probably quite a few that end up on the low side of the weight versus the regular population. That's a significant and practically large effect. In both terms, we have found something that's important and that is truly influencing our sample. Slide 28 gives a nice summary of this. Statistical significance is about how sure you are that an effect is real, not the size of the effect. Cohen's D is telling you how big the effect is, and again, in which direction. That negative 0.8 means we've shifted our mean down, and by a large margin. Cohen's D is not whether groups are different, it's how big the effect. And statistical significance, how sure are we the effect is real, or how sure are we that these groups are truly different. At this point, I think it's time for me to stop jabbering away in your ears through this podcast, and let's do some practice. In particular, with the one sample, it's going to be listed as t-test in SPSS. So I'd like you to pull up SPSS and follow the instructions on page 192 under the using SPSS to perform a z-test heading. So you're actually going to be typing in your data, right? There's a listing of approximately 10 data points. And then you follow the instructions where it says, after the data are entered, click Analyze, then Compare Means, then one sample t-test, and you'll see the results. Now, what you should see looks pretty similar to what is in your textbook. They're going to show you the one sample t-test kind of command there, where it says you've got to move score over to test variable, and be very, very clear on step three, you need to enter a test value in the test value box. That's really what it's comparing against to figure out if that sample value is different than our population. You'll see the one sample statistics at the bottom, and so long as you get the same results as what are in the book, consider yourself in great shape. If you get something different, repeat the test, okay? Also, not a bad idea to read through the understanding the SPSS output here because it helps walk you through what are the different values in the test and how do we read whether this is significant or not. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we are done with the one sample test conversation. So we need to touch on a few other things in this episode. The first being your peer review assignments. Okay. So you finished your initial draft for peer reviews, you're ready to get feedback, but how exactly is this going to work? Well, I'm going to assign you two papers using the peer reviews, and it's going to be marked as the assignment called Peer Reviews Rubric and Marked Up Copy Submission, okay? Peer Reviews Rubric and Marked Up Copy Submission. When you open that assignment, you're going to see by Friday, October 31st, that you have two papers assigned to you to read. So for the assignment, read both papers, and then there is a rubric for you to fill out. It doesn't have points in it, but it has sections. So if I have opened up a paper, essentially what I'll be looking at is this peer review questions, and it's got 2024 in it because it was originally developed then. But you're needing to fill out the boxes that say, what are the paper highlights or strengths? What are the recommended additions? What was confusing or hard to follow? And then how about that data and hypotheses discussion? Was the description of the data clear and understandable? Are the hypotheses listed in the paper? Do you have any recommendations for making changes to that language? And keep in mind, data is going to change significantly between the initial draft and the final draft. Because for many people, you'll be using a fake data set, not your ideal data that you've put into the initial draft. Then, of course, there are other recommendations you can make to help them with creating a better draft, but that's only step one of the peer review process. The other thing you need to do is complete what are known as electronic annotations, so highlighting or putting comments electronically on the document. If you've never done this, it's a pretty easy, straightforward process. You just have to get familiar with the tools. And at the bottom of the description of the peer reviews rubric and marked up copy submission assignment are some links, which I've called videos and resources to assist with completing annotations and rubrics. There's four links there specifically, some that are a basic instruction kind of document, some that are YouTube videos, okay? And so hopefully with these, you're able to navigate the requirements of this assignment and, in short, get both done by the deadline, which is November 9th. So you'll have these available to you October 31st. The expectation is by Sunday, November 9th, you'll have submitted these. And then the folks who wrote those papers can see your feedback. Now, always one note of kindness and caution. Be kind in your feedback. There's really not much to be gained by being, let's say, unnecessarily rude. And I certainly don't consider it appropriate for this type of forum. Because we're learning and we're trying to build on our skills. We're not trying to cut people down. So keep the comments kind, but be honest too. There's a fine line we walk here. Yes, maybe your introduction is not well written, but I think instead of putting it like that simply, I would say, I think there's room for improvement in your introduction, and here's how I think you could make it better. Give constructive criticism, meaning helpful suggestions and hints on ways to improve the document and the draft, rather than simply saying, something sucks. Nobody wants to hear that, and it's not really very helpful in creating a better paper, which is the whole point of this activity. By November 9th, you should have the feedback from others in the course who've been assigned your paper, unless, of course, they don't do it, which is a real possibility. So if you don't have comments by November 9th, it's probably because the individual didn't get those done. And rather than chase each other down, I'm simply going to say take what feedback you have and move forward in finishing the paper. Don't wait till November 16th or 23rd to continue making progress on this when you don't know if that feedback will ever be coming. I'm going to encourage you all to take this seriously, support one another, and do the work, but I can't force you. So know that by November 9th is the expectation. There may be some instances in case of emergency where I contact you and say, hey, there's going to be feedback coming to you a little bit later, so please be open to that. But I really don't expect that if you get any feedback after the 9th that you'll necessarily incorporate it into your paper. I will also be trying to get your feedback done by then. I may need a little bit more time given the number of papers that I'm looking at, but I hope to have it completed to you no later than November 16th so that you have a few weeks to incorporate the suggestions that I make. That's a wrap on the peer reviews then and the general process for feedback on the papers, which leaves us with not much this semester. We have SPSS assignments 3 and 4, which are listed as work on in class, but as you know, you're taking this online, so it'll be on your own time. You can always reach out and let me know what questions you have in the process of completing those assignments. And this is the stage at which I say, if you want to work ahead, you have full blessings to do so. Please make progress as you see fit. And if things are making great sense to you, read ahead, work ahead, do what you can to make the workload more manageable for you. We have quizzes 5, 6, and 7 still available to you at this point. Remember, you only need to do 5. So if you've done 5 and you're happy with the scores, there's no need to do more. If you've done 5 and you're not happy with the scores, you can submit more and I'll take your top 5. Next, we have our absolute last online discussion the week of November 17th, which is only a few short weeks away. There's no more after that, so make sure, again, you're getting your 5 done that you need for the final grade. And then I've listed the deadlines for our big final assignments, the final draft of the paper by Sunday, December 7th, and your final exam, which will only be in one section this time around, is going to be due on midnight, December 11th. If you were in class in person, that would be something we'd administer in a 2-hour time slot, so that's what you'll have. 2 hours to answer questions in 3 sections. It's the same format as the midterm. You'll answer 1 question per section, so you'll have a total of 3 responses to submit in the 2 hours. I'll give more details on that exam as we make progress toward it, but for now, just keep those things in mind. And know, y'all, we're only a slightly bit more than a month away from being done. So keep up the good work. Review chapters 11 and 12, which are going to introduce us to t-tests, where we compare 2 sample groups. And as always, email me with any questions or concerns. I look forward to getting those emails when I do see them. It's nice to have you guys reach out and connect, especially when you connect with what's in this podcast. Okay. Gonna wrap it up there. Have a great rest of your day, night, week, weekend, wherever you're at. And I'll talk with you again soon.